Thank you very much, and it's nice to be here. It's my first APHA, and it will definitely be my last because I can't afford to spend 12 hours at least trying to get registered, send in my abstracts, and do everything else on the internet. I'm also very pleased to see the crowd here. I didn't know there were so many socialists around still. Bigger than I thought. I have no relationships that I'd care to disclose here. So I want to quickly spend about a half of my time talking about the context within which People's Health Movement operates, and particularly focusing on Africa. And then I want to talk about PHM itself and the International People's Health University. So I think everyone is aware of the global health crisis, which most particularly affects Africa and South Asia. And this just depicts young child mortality. And as you can see, it's overwhelmingly concentrated in those two regions, as is tuberculosis, and I could go on. Life expectancy in many parts of the world has gone up, although if you do an equity analysis on it, it's not so impressive for poorer groups. But you can see in sub-Saharan Africa and, of course, in the former Soviet bloc, there's been very little increase or, in fact, a decline in life expectancy. And in Africa, very low levels of life expectancy. So what are the root causes of these problems? Obviously, I haven't time to go into any detailed analysis, but in my view, increasing poverty and inequality are root causes, as is what currently goes for health policy, and I'm going to speak a little bit about those too. So, globalization, of course, has been happening for centuries, but we've only started to call it globalization in the past period. And we date, I think, current globalization to the debt crisis. So Africa, in which I'm particularly interested, is highly indebted. As you can see, Africa's borrowed over $500 billion in the past 35 years, paid back the same amount, but still owes $300 billion. Of course, that's a small amount when you think of what banks get when they get bailed out. But for Africa, this is a huge burden. And it really interferes with social programs. Globalization, of course, is very complex. I just wanted to focus briefly on the trade component. So we're told that liberalization of trade is going to solve the poor world's problems. But actually, there's already a lot of evidence that liberalization is destroying many sectors. In Cape Town, where I live, the textile sector was the biggest employer of black women, and it's been decimated in the last decade or so by cheap imports. And there are other examples, of course, of how lowering trade barriers has interfered with economic activity. This is a quote from the Commission on Social Determinants of Health, noting that transnational corporations have flourished with trade liberalization, and on the size of transnational corporations, you can see that many of them are bigger in terms of their revenues than the GDP of even sizable countries like South Africa. And that trade agreements and liberalization have severely interfered with countries' capacities to ensure that economic activity contributes to health equity. And then, of course, it's not only being done to us. There are internal problems in countries. And as you know, there's a lot of looting going on. Back in the 80s, when Mary Bassett and I were working in Zimbabwe, we used to have the slogan, "A luta continua," the struggle continues. Unfortunately, in Zimbabwe now, they say the looting continues, which it does. So what's been the result of this? Huge increase in global wealth, but very uneven. This is a World Bank graph showing how wealth has increased very slowly in the 20 poorest countries in 40 years. You can see from 212 to 270 US dollars per capita GDP, whereas it's tripled to much higher levels in the 20 richest countries. And again, this is depicted on World Mapper. So you can see now the obverse of the mortality indicators. And so in Africa, poverty has increased quite dramatically. In fact, the number of people living in extreme poverty, that is less than one US dollar per day, has almost doubled between 1980 and 2000. So why should the Japanese cow enjoy a higher income than an African citizen? Japanese cows subsidized to the tune of $2,600, and African citizens' income per capita is about 500 per annum. I believe the EU cows are very upset that the Japanese cows are doing better than they are from the agricultural subsidy. So what about the health system itself? Well, people will know of the famous Alma-Ata conference in 1978, where primary health care was codified. So this concept wasn't just about basic health care. It was also about addressing social determinants. It wasn't called social determinants at that time, but if you read the Alma-Ata documents, it's very clear that the social, economic, and political causes of poor health were fundamental to the strategy addressing them. And in fact, it called for a new international economic order. Soon after the declaration, though, there was a split in the primary health care movement to what's now being called selective primary health care, a much narrower conception where a few cost-effective technologies were identified. Now, these are very cost-effective, but the problem is, if we just look at diarrhea, how would one address diarrhea with a comprehensive approach? You can see that these interventions are only a small part of what's necessary to deal with the problem of diarrhea. And the so-called promotive interventions, which address social determinants, have been largely neglected. Now, health sector reform, which was introduced in the early 90s, and now has been undertaken in many poor countries, in my view, has many continuities with selective primary health care. There's an overwhelming focus on technical efficiency and economic efficiency. And of course, this is aggravated, in my view, by the advent of global health partnerships. Now, people will know about some of these. The most famous, of course, are the financial mechanisms like the Global Fund, but also others like Stop TB, Roll Back Malaria, the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, and so on, where money from the public, but particularly from the private sector and foundations, is allocated for particular disease problems. And this shows the growth of these global health initiatives year on year, and there are now over 100 of these. And developing country governments have to contend with them. Now, of course, they've made new resources available, especially for AIDS. You can see that since the Global Fund was formed and PEPFAR, there was an exponential rise in AIDS funding. But big disruptions to health systems. In the year 2000, Tanzania was preparing thousands of quarterly reports on different aid-funded projects and hosted many, many donor visits. And then there's a sustainability question. This is Ethiopia, and you can see AIDS funding in Ethiopia is primarily from PEPFAR, the Global Fund, the World Bank. And the Ethiopian government contribution is the tiny little blue block on the left. So if there were a change in global funding, You can imagine how many people would be without treatment. Then there's the problem of human resources. So Africa has 25% of the global disease burden and about 3%, this is an underestimate, of global health workforce. And of course, many of them are migrating. And I'm in fact one of those. I'm one of Zimbabwe's migrants to South Africa, but many have migrated abroad. Who wins and who loses? The UN estimates that almost $200,000 is saved in training costs by the developed countries when they import a fully trained professional. So if you calculate that up, this is very expensive reverse aid. So in summary, we have a huge problem. Even immunization, which was one of the successes of the selective primary healthcare era, has stagnated. The yellow bars show global coverage of immunization, and the red line is African coverage. So you can see with even DTP3, African coverage is about 50%. And if you do an equity analysis on that, only about 30% of children in the poorest economic quintile are getting even the basic vaccines. So this is the context of the response. So in December 2000, some organizations got together to hold what we called a People's Health Assembly as a counterpoint to the World Health Assembly, because we felt that by 2000, and we held it in December just to make absolutely sure, health for all would not have been achieved. So in the year, we waited as long as possible. So we were overwhelmed, really, by the response. Over 90 countries were represented, about 2,000 or 1,500 people attended. And the website is here. And it was agreed that we need to take action at all levels. We formulated a charter for health, which is really a tool for advocacy. And there are copies at the back, and here is one copy of the charter, which is now translated into about 60 different languages. This talks about tackling the social determinants, but also about a people-centered health sector. So from that assembly, a movement was created. We see the health crisis as a microcosm, really, of the current global regime, unfair global regime. And we strive to achieve health by all, both by addressing social determinants and revitalizing primary health care. We governed by periodic People's Health Assemblies. The next one is actually scheduled for 2012, not 2011. And between gatherings, there's a coordinating steering council with regional and network representations. There's a small secretariat based in Cape Town with outposts also in Cairo and in Delhi. And we function through a number of global programs, amongst which is the International People's Health University, which I'll talk about in a moment, but also Global Health Watch, a publication of ours, and a Right to Health campaign. We have some presence in about 70 countries, in some countries very large, like in India, Bangladesh, and some of the Central American countries, and in others very small. So these are where we are strong and where we are just embryonic. This is our second People's Health Assembly in Ecuador. And we produce also Global Health Watch, which is an alternative to the World Health Report. And you can download this free from the internet. It's an extremely useful resource. And many people use this in teaching, but also in their campaigns. We have a Global Right to Health campaign, which takes different shapes in different countries. And now, finally, the IPHU. So This is a project which was launched really at our second assembly in Ecuador in 2005. Its main objective is really to contribute to building a new layer of health activists. We try to attract to the various courses that we run, and these are mostly 12-day courses. It's a virtual university, and we try and recruit to that health activists. So since 2005, we've had 16 of these in different parts of the world. They're depicted on this slide. And each course is often conducted in a number of different languages to allow a wider range of participation. The course program tries to enhance the analysis capacity of participants to enable them to identify and develop more effective strategies and actions. And the contents cover social determinants of health, trade, the architecture of global health governance. We usually have a day on health systems and primary health care. Financing of health care, including development assistance, and on action-oriented research. And then there's always, depending on where the IPHU is held, local issues which are particularly pertinent to that country or that region. And there's quite a lot of sharing of experiences between participants and collective work on future plans and campaigns, including research projects, and I'll show this in a moment. The faculty tend to be academics from different academic institutions around the world, and always some local contributors as well, local resource people, and we're increasingly using alumni of previous IPHUs as resource people. So there are a number of universities involved, not all are mentioned, but some of them are mentioned on this slide, and we are seeking ways as well to credit these courses for formal recognition. So far we've had about 700 participants altogether from 53 countries. We've managed to raise scholarship money for about 40% of participants. Participants, in order to be accepted, have to demonstrate that they have been involved in health activism. They have to convince us with a written motivation why they would benefit and their country or organization would benefit from attendance. We've tried to keep up contact amongst participants after each course and provide assistance for implementation of some of the projects that participants have taken up. And we've used this course to try and develop PHM country circles. So one example, there's a current project on community health action where there is research going on at the moment just in Brazil, but it will expand to other areas, to analyze community health actions to better inform policy making. So the stages of this proposed project are depicted here. And there's another project which emanated from the first IPHU, which is now funded under a Canadian grant, the Teasdale-Corti grant, which is now in its third year. And we have 24 projects globally on comprehensive primary health care, which are being researched and documented and will be presented next year in Ottawa in our final meeting. So we are currently planning a number of IPHUs for next year, and one of them will be held in the US. It's planned for the Bronx. So people who are interested from the US should sign up for that or see Sarah, who's at the back. We're also having a meeting today between 4 and 5 People's Health Movement meeting at booth 1304 in the exhibit hall. So we still experience some constraints, big constraints, both in IPH and PHM, in terms of financial resources and institutional capacity. So we now have infrastructure and a curriculum to build capacity for health activism. More than 700 alumni who are currently engaged in their own countries and at global level. And I would encourage you to look at the website of People's Health Movement, where you can access both IPHU, also our other campaigns, and Global Health Watch. Thank you.